I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, you're listening to The BIP Show. BIP is for Business, Investing and Policy. That's what we're here to talk about. I'm Paul Colgan, director at CT Group. James Whelan is on assignment on a boat somewhere in Sydney Harbour. But joining me on the line from Amsterdam is Ken Vexler, Managing Director and Chief Investment Officer at Acumen Management. How are you, Ken?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, Colga. I'm well. A little bit cold. It is getting somewhat brisk here, especially in the morning, but all good.
Yeah, things are good. It is absolutely beautiful. It is genuinely the most perfect day you have seen in Sydney for a long time. We are recording this at 6 p.m. in Sydney on November the 26th, 2020. Now, Ken, a starter question for you. Things are not going all that terribly well in Europe. Is Amsterdam busy now? Like, are the CBDs like firing, etc.?
Well, first off, you're right. Things aren't going all that well in Europe, but I take no responsibility for that. It's not my fault, Colgo.
For once, exactly.
The CBD, it's here in Amsterdam. There's an area not dissimilar to Canary Wharf in London, and in fact, I live. Probably, I don't know, maybe a 10-minute walk, a 5-minute bike ride from there. Luckily, it's not like the Isle of Dogs. It's, you know, it's different. But and I go past there regularly, and it's still very, very, very quiet. I mean, it's probably a little bit up on, obviously, the spring and, you know, March, April times. But in that particular segment, it's still very quiet. Elsewhere in Amsterdam, you know, the more creative, like the Paddingtons, if you equate it to Sydney and the like, yeah, bits and pieces going on, but, you know, it's very much still work from home if you can, and if you absolutely cannot, then don't. Are things firing? Not really, man. I mean, you know, people are around, but, yeah, not that much.
So I think it's a really interesting question, isn't it? After the pure awfulness of this past year, which, to be honest, I'm glad we're nearly at the end of, but there is this really interesting question which is around land use. And I'm about to use this as a segue to introduce our fantastic guest. But the Sydney CBD is picking up again a little bit. And you can tell at the same time, it's nowhere near as like crowded, busy, energized as it was before. At the same time, you know, you hear a lot of excitement in a lot of quarters around, you know, the idea about like we can all work from home. And it's a revolution, you know, we can work from anywhere. Now, obviously, this is an issue for Australian cities, but it's also an issue for cities like Amsterdam, London, Berlin, Rome, Milan, anywhere that there's mixed industrial use. And, of course, it raises, I think, what is a really scary question. If you can do your job from Bondi, why can't it be done from Bangalore? To discuss all of this, we're joined by one of the preeminent spatial economists in Australia. It's Terry Ronsley, who was, until recently, a principal and partner at SGS Economics, a very highly respected consultancy. He will be joining, might be breaking some news here, Terry will be joining KPMG next year, working on in the transport and infrastructure practices. Terry really understands, I've known the guy for a while, but he really understands how economic activity breaks down across physical space in Australia in incredible detail. Terry Ronsley, welcome to the BIP Show.
Paul, thanks for that very complimentary introduction.
Terry, let's get straight into it. Okay, so to your mind, what have been the standout things that we've learned about the distribution of economic activity this year?
Well, you know, in Australia, a couple of things kept ticking along. So the mining and agricultural sectors, you know, was business as usual pretty much. You know, what I call, you know, knowledge-intensive industries, so, you know, information media, finance, insurance, you know, accountants, lawyers, you know, they transitioned to working from home and kept on ticking along pretty well. But I'll talk about that in a minute. But it's really that sort of that face-to-face retail food services which got smashed with all the restrictions.
One of the things here is that a lot of corporates actually did completely fine.
Yeah, and a lot of corporates, you know, over the last, you know, probably 10 years have been, you know, embracing the work from home trend. The good people at the Bureau of Statistics ran a survey a couple of years ago where they asked people if they'd worked from home. And about 50% of the workforce responded they had done some work from home. So that could be someone working from home 5 days a week or doing a day a week from home or even, like, you know, catching up on some emails after the kids have gone to bed. But that sort of 50% of people were already to some degree working from home, and that big corporates have just basically just pivoted to keep that whole workforce ticking along with COVID by picking back off the infrastructure they built up, the cultures they built up around working from home.
So the interesting thing here is the infrastructure that they'd built up. So there's infrastructure that the country builds up in terms of NBN, the telco, the investments that telcos make because they can, you know, private companies think they can make a profit off it, etc. But then there's also the investment that companies make in these systems, isn't it right? Like, so it's, we're starting to get down into the weeds of this really, really quickly, right?
Yeah.
But it gets down to company level too, doesn't it? Like the decisions companies make themselves and then how their workforce responds to that.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, COVID's probably done more for companies, you know, digital transformation strategies than any CEO could have done, because it's forced people to sort of really embrace it. And from talking to a whole range of different people, that there were companies which were already on this, you know, working from home, work from the office, work from your client's location. And then there was others, when COVID hit, they were like, gee, our staff don't have laptops. We don't have a VPN, you know, all this IT infrastructure that haven't even thought about, they had to try and throw together. Whereas other ones was like, okay, let's just send everyone home in March and the system will hold up and away we go.
So completely selfish reason for doing a show on this, but I wrote a column that got published on Monday in the Sydney Morning Herald about this, because I genuinely think there's a risk of a lot of economic activity getting destroyed by people not being in cities. So how much is really going to change in CBD districts, in your opinion? And this is going to lead us, I think, into a broader conversation, but let's just start with that. How much is going to change in our cities?
Yeah, and this is sort of, you know, a bit of an unknown. And people get, you know, really, you know, we talk about coffees and lunches, you know, in Sydney CBD. It's like, oh, well, look, you know, I'm working from Bondi, I'm buying my coffee there, so no big deal. But when you look at the Sydney City of Sydney, it generates about $140 billion worth of income in a normal year. Only about $20 billion of that is food services retail. $100 billion of it is this knowledge-intensive sector I talked about. And this is a danger, Paul, that, you know, that sector, if working from home is costing you even like a 1%, you know, impact on your productivity, you know, that's going to add up to millions of dollars very quickly.
So at $120 billion, if you start to slice that down just a little bit here and there in productivity and in economic output that contributes to the national accounts, let's be clear about this, you know, in terms of GDP growth, all of this stuff, you know, we're not just talking about like fanciful numbers in terms of, you know, when we say $120 billion, we're talking about like the real stuff, the real dollar amount that turns into GDP output at the end of the day, right?
Yeah, so it's almost 10% of Sydney's GDP. Australia's GDP is coming from the Sydney CBD there. And if you think about, you know, we get excited if there's 1%, you know, productivity growth in a year. what I'm talking about. We could lose that 1% and we have no productivity growth, and then our 3% GDP growth, which is built on 1% productivity growth, you know, goes down over the longer term.
You might be able to talk about this compounding effect of like lost productivity. 1% of lost productivity compounded can turn into, you know, significant, like tens of millions of dollars.
It's the multiplier effect, Colgo. You're not an economist, neither am I, but let's simplify it. The multiplier effect of the diminished 1% in productivity, where does it kick on?
And you sort of, you think about, you know, people at home are going, well, what are they talking about productivity being lost? And the example I give, if I'm in a meeting room with four people and I'm trying to explain some economic concept to them, I can pretty quickly tell if one of those four people is confused by what I'm saying, because I can read the cues. Whereas if I've got four people on a Zoom call, it's much harder to pick up on those subtle ones. So I might do my in-person meeting and I see, hey, Paul, you look confused about, you know, productivity. Let's unpack that now. Whereas on the Zoom call, I've got no idea you're confused and you go away none the wiser, and hence that impacts on the job you're trying to do.
There is a productivity benefit and an economic opportunity in what you just talked about there, Terry, which is the congregation of companies and people in a physical location, right? So, which we would typically call it like a CBD. As you said, one of the common complaints people have about the idea that there's no economic sacrifice in moving out to living in the suburbs is that, like, you know, well, the retail dollars, like, they'll just transfer out to our communities, and don't we want our communities to be supported? And absolutely, yes, we do. But we also want thriving, brilliant central business districts in the major Australian urban centres. That is going to come with people being invested in it. And I worry that people, in the excitement that there is around, you know, let's, you know, all go home and work from home and have this fantastic work-life balance, that we'll actually cut a whole bunch of economic activity out of our overall community and a whole bunch of benefits that come with that. But it's incredibly hard to measure. So it comes back to this productivity question. But is there any way to measure the benefit of physical co-location of companies?
Yeah, and what I've done in the past is, like, you look at the income generated by different businesses in the same industry across Sydney. And what you find is that the closer you get into the city, the more productive the businesses are. And this is observed in Sydney, New York, you know, any city around the world. And it's been observed, you know, in the last 20 years, the last 200 years. And to use a big fancy word, you know, it's all about the agglomeration economies. Actually, that's two words. But this agglomeration, it's hard to explain, because it's all this very nuanced. It's like you're in a coffee line, you bump into a collaborator, you have a chat, and you learn something, you know? It's not like you've called them up on Skype and had a chat. You've bumped into him, you've learned some gossip, for want of a better word. You've learned some intel that you go and try and do your job better. Or you bump into a client, you find out there's some work coming out and you want to know how to position yourself. And also in this knowledge-intensive sort of industry, you know, so much of it is based around, you know, social capital and trust in the people that you're working with. And, you know, Paul, you know, I've met you in real life. We went out for lunch, you know, had some beers. I remember you paid for it, you know, that's a tick in your column. So when you messaged me and said, you want to come on here? I said, oh, yeah, sure. You know, Paul bought me a couple of beers and he's a good guy. I met him. So you just can't get that same sort of trust and social capital built up in the virtual world. And there was some research I saw, you know, pre-COVID, which showed that people you lived or worked closer to, you tended to have more virtual interactions with. So, you know, you bump into someone in the foyer, you know, you'll email them because you've seen them, or you email them and you arrange to catch up. It's harder if you don't see people. It's like, oh, I haven't seen Paul in a few months or a few years. Like, it's harder to email them. But even if you see, hey, there's Paul crossing the street. Hey, there's Ken. You know, he's in Amsterdam. You know, you see it. You feel more connected to the people because it's tangible. It's that social capital coming through.
Is that the same as the concept of, I suppose, recency bias? So basically, if I haven't seen you in 6 months, out of sight, out of mind. But if you're there, you know, then I think, oh, yeah, by the way, I should have done this, or how about a coffee with him, or whatever it is. Is that the same sort of principle you're talking about?
Exactly, yeah. It's that that visual social interaction. And you don't have to stop and have a big chat, but you're seeing, oh, Paul, there he is across the street. And even this is where it gets harder to explain. It's the network effect. Like, you know, I might bump into Paul and he says, oh, yeah, Ken's in Amsterdam and this is happening. So these networks flow out, and then I go, oh, I'm going to be talking to my friend. Oh, you're going to Amsterdam. You should see Ken and, you know, have a chat and do some business.
Right. So can you put some hard numbers around this?
Just in last financial year, so that sort of initial lockdown in Sydney, you know, this loss of this agglomeration, you know, this productivity was probably going to cost the Sydney and New South Wales and Australian economy, you know, something like $4 or $5 billion in lost productivity by looking at this historical relationship between firms which are more suburban and firms which are more CBD.
A few things that are awesome about cities: they create economies of scale, right? So they bring a workforce together. They often are situated in places that are great to be, right? So for various reasons. So they might be great exporting locations like London is, or like Sydney is. But they also might just be great stop-off points. They're places where people come together because it's easy to come together to do things that improve your life, but also for people to congregate and also solve common problems. And the lesson of history is also to tell you that if you invest and concentrate people in these areas, that you get economic benefits. And we need to be working like physically together in order to get the maximum benefit from our efforts. Is that a ridiculous thesis, or is it sound, as you might say?
Well, no, yeah, you know, you've said a lot there, Paul, and made a lot of good points. And, you know, I don't have a classical education. I grew up in North Queensland. But, like, you think about, you know, ancient Greek philosophers, they all came to Athens so they could be together and bounce ideas off each other. And that's sort of the same sort of holds today. You know, if you want to be in financial markets, New York, London, Sydney are the places to go. If you want to be in, you know, the movies, you go to Hollywood. If you want to be in, you know, Silicon Valley, if you want to, you know, really make a name for yourself. So all these places have that, you know, people, skill, businesses that all feed off each other. And while the way I just sort of describe it is, you know, we've had this period of, you know, 2020 where we've sort of been on life support of working from home, you know, people's relationships have held up in the virtual world. Everyone's in this together, so to speak. But, you know, as you move into 2021, you know, you'll have this situation where people will be onboarded into organizations and start working with people who you'd never met. And, you know, if this goes on and on, you won't have that social capital I talked about, that incidental conversations going on, and it will start to eat away. So while working from home is part of the future, you just can't rely solely on working from home.
There are a couple of things to my mind. One is, first and foremost, humans are social creatures. They crave and they require social interaction, be that in the workplace, be that outside of work, in their leisure life and whatever else. Obviously, extenuating circumstances this year, if we're to believe that a vaccine is imminent and everything that flows on inside the next probably 18 or so months, we would look globally at the world returning to some, I say some in inverted commas, form of normal, right? Which means that people go back to work, maybe not 5 days a week and whatever else. You know, I just don't believe that the world and the CBDs and whatever else is now, you know, that's it. We're in a new paradigm. We're in a new situation whereby things change dramatically and for good, as in that's it. They'll never go back. I think, you know, people like to say, oh, I like to work from home. But let me tell you, it's not all it's cracked up to be. And I mean, there have been hundreds of articles written in the last 9 months about that. So I suppose economically, I think, and Terry, please speak to this, I think economically there will be inevitably a push to go back to physically being in the office. Maybe not as it was in 2019 and all the years prior, but, you know, I still don't think that that's it, that the tide has turned and, you know, off we go. So, I mean, the co-location of being in the same room or the same proximity or whatever, is, you know, Can you talk to that point at all, please, Terry?
Yeah, and, you know, there's been some sort of opinion polling done, you know, across the world about people's perceptions. And the way I describe it is there's 25% of the population just itching to get back into the office. They are just super keen to get back in there because they're social creatures or they've got a pile of kids at home, which makes it hard to work from home. Then there's 25% of people who are like, yeah, no, I'm never coming back into the office. See you later. This is for me, working from home forever. And then there's 50%.
They're hipsters. So you say 25% of the population are hipsters.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding.
Oh, well, you know, I live in Brunswick in Melbourne, which is, you know, got a very high hipster ratio. But anyway, it's a podcast for another day. And then you get 50% sort of in the middle who say, well, like, yeah, look, working from home a day or 2 weeks, fine. I'll come into the office, you know, and see you. So it's really that 50% of people who you just got to convince that saying, well, look, there is value in coming in. And this is where this sort of paradox of thrift, you know, concept. So paradox of this, you know, very old economic concept saying, if I save some dollars, that's good for me, but the economy as a whole misses out because there's less spending going on. So if everyone saves, individually it's good, but as a nation, the economy is worse off.
There genuinely is this question of, like, what's good for me might not necessarily be good for my community. What might be your best choice is not exactly what the rest of the community needs long term, right? So that we need people coming into the city and being together in an office, right? So, and I think that at the company level, this is where it gets completely fascinating to me. What are companies telling their people about working from home? Because if you surveyed 500 people, do you want to come back to the office? They will say yes, and there will be a certain proportion that says no.
Yeah, but it's exactly the thing saying, well, look, you think about, like, if you're a really experienced member of your organization and you being in the office means that less experienced people can go, oh, hey, there's Paul over there. I'm just going to go ask him a question, or, you know, we bump into each other at the photocopier and I learn something from you, or you solve the problem in 1 minute, which would take an hour, you know, for a more junior person to solve. You know, it's important to have those people in the office some days of the week so they can sort of impart the knowledge. They might sit at home and go, well, look, you know, my commute's long and painful, so I'm just going to stay at home. So it saves them, paradox of thrift, you know, some time or some money, but their peers or the in their company misses out from that productivity that they can bring with them when they're physically in the office.
Do you think, Terry, that people should be getting back to work in CBDs?
Yes. I think it's really interesting. If you look at Perth and Adelaide, who have had a very good COVID run for the past year, their CBD is at sort of 60 or 70% capacity. And for me, that's that sort of two groups talked about before. People were keen to get back and the other 50%. But they're still missing a third of their workers, which means there's this missing agglomeration. So encouraging those people, those holdouts who might still have, you know, concerns about getting on public transport, you know, don't like their commute, don't like their jobs, getting those people drawn back into the CBDs is really important. And then you look at Sydney, which I think is about 40 or 50% capacity, and then Melbourne CBD is about 10% capacity. So getting those CBDs, you know, more active. You know, we won't probably go back to a point where, and we never were at the point where every worker went to the office 5 days a week. You know, a lot of people, you know, might have worked from home waiting for those elusive tradies to come round, or worked from home 1 day a week to do drop off and pick up for the kids. You know, that's was always there pre-COVID. But post-COVID, you know, you might just have a little bit more of that happening, but still it's so important to get people back into those CBDs to get companies' internal ecosystems of productivity recharged, ensuring that broader ecosystem of innovation and productivity is back to where it was pre-COVID with all these social capitals, agglomeration economies I've been rambling on about for the last half hour.
Terry, you've probably answered the next question, but I'll ask it anyway. I mean, do you see the instance and of COVID and obviously everything we've gone through over the last year and will continue to go through for a bit longer? I mean, is this the catalyst to change a dynamic that's been, well, decades in the making? I mean, CBDs aren't unique to Sydney or to Melbourne or to Perth. You know, it's a global phenomenon, and they're there for a reason. We've also seen in the last, I don't know, probably two decades, you know, I liken it again to Sydney, you know, the Paddingtons and the Willaras and whatever else, fringe, CBD fringes springing up, and probably the inner west, you know, the more creatives, the more whatever else. So the dynamic is adjusting, but is COVID really a reason or the reason for all of a sudden to abandon the CBD phenomena and look to, you know, to go elsewhere or to change that whole thing? I mean, I personally don't think so, but, you know, you tell me.
The death of the CBD is been predicted for, you know, decades. You know, if you go back, right, as I've done, and look at the literature around when telephones were first introduced, that was said, oh, well, look, you just pick up a phone, you don't need to be in the CBD, we'll go to our suburban offices. And that didn't really happen. The same thing with, you know, teleworking, as it was called back in the old days, you know, working from home. All these things have come part of the working life, but as you said earlier, Ken, you know, humans are social creatures. They need to see each other. They absorb information best when they are in person. And that will be the draw card which holds the CBDs together. And what I think will happen is, as we move into 2021, you know, companies which get their workforces back into the office in the appropriate way will see that productivity dividend spark straight away. And then there'll be, you know, this competition between firms saying, well, this firm's got its CBD office back and running. It's doing really well. Competitors who might have been slow in getting back in the CBD will have to get back in there and compete with them, and that will draw more people and more workers back into the CBD.
So that's very invisible hand, Terry. So what can be done on the policy side to incentivize businesses and also workers to get back into physical locations?
Yeah, I think we have a muscle memory problem over the last, you know, 9 months that people have got used to working from home. And moving into 2021, it's just getting those, you know, those nudges to get people back on the train, the tram, the bus, the ferry, whatever, and getting back into that routine of the daily commute. And I think a lot of this is, you know, in Australia at least, we've got a very good narrative to tell people COVID is under control, wear your mask, you know, keep your distance, you know, wash your hands, back to where we were messaging earlier in the year. And this will keep you safe as you travel into the city to make it happen there. So I think it's still a lot of subtle stuff. I don't think there's any, you know, policy lever. The City of Melbourne sort of announced reductions in car parking rates, which I don't think is going to do a great deal because there's no, you know...
not everybody's rushing to...
Yeah.
Hooray, $8 in off my parking every day.
Exactly, yeah.
It's not strong enough, yeah.
Yeah, and I've been going into the Melbourne CBD for the last 4 weeks, you know, a lot of days, and, you know, when I went in there like 4 weeks ago, it felt like a Sunday morning. Now, this is a weekday morning. It felt like a Sunday morning, you know. Cafes and bars were, you know, shut. You know, I tried to find a counter meal. Went to all the old usual pubs who were, you know, always open in the old days, and they were all shut. So, and over the weeks, like I've talked to, you know, cafes who are open. I said, like, is it worthwhile opening up? And they say, no, not really. But it's really good to be open because they're slowly seeing people return. And when I was in there earlier in the week, it was probably the most active it's been. It felt like a busy Sunday morning. There was like the tradies have been sort of underpinning a lot of the cafes in there. But there was more tourists sort of wandering around. And one really reassuring sign for me was seeing parents, mothers exclusively, with their kids in prams coming in for a bit of a wander in the city. So that was really reassuring that that group feels safe to travel into the CBD and wander around and do some stuff. But it's going to take a while.
But there's a question here, a really big question here, which is it basically comes down to maths. Fundamentally, a lot of those businesses in the CBD need a certain amount of cash flow, not just to cover their costs and make a profit, but to cover their debts. Right. So, and this is where this stuff starts to become problematic for us at a society level. If there's enough debt underwater, it starts to create, I don't want to say systemic problems, because that's kind of alarmist language. But it can cause, it's the kind of thing that can cause a kind of double dip recession. Am I pushing this too far, Terry, or Ken? You tell me.
I'll answer for me. I think you are sort of pushing the boat out a little bit here. I mean, look, if we're talking about policy or measures by which to incentivize people to go back into the CBD and whatever else, honestly, money talks, bullshit walks. I don't think this is so much a governmental prerogative. A bit of background. Let's put things in perspective and in relative terms. Australia is as safe as houses when it comes to COVID. I mean, a couple of weeks ago here, every day in Holland, there were 10,000 new cases. Every day, right? In Australia, I don't know, you're getting what? Maybe 20 across the whole country, if that.
The entire state of Victoria was locked down.
Yeah, I understand. But I suppose where I'm getting at in terms of incentivizing people to go back, basically it should be up to the employers to, and this is going to sound brutal, to say, we are now instituting a policy where you work 3 days in the office, 2 days at home. If you don't come into the office, you no longer have a job. In a job market that's as tight as this one, that's as much incentive as you need to give people, honestly. The government can only do so much. I mean, they're going to make tram rides free, give you 4 free coffees. Like, they can't, and they're strapped as it is, right? So that's it. I mean, that's the reality. And in terms of what you're talking about, you know, creating debt if businesses, you know, the supporting businesses in the CBDs go under and whatever else, okay, obviously it's extreme in this instance because there's been a greater cause or reason for them to maybe go under. But honestly, with ever-increasing leases in normal times and staff costs and this, that, and the other, honestly, you know how many, you know, the turnover in businesses in the CBD on an average CBD in a normal year is huge, right? So I don't think this is going to create any systemic risk or any, it's just going to be a bit of rationalization. And that's
The collapse in revenue for these guys is like 70, 80, 90% for a lot of cafes and restaurants and bars, right? So let's make it a simple assumption, right, that your rental costs, and this would be cheap in a CBD location, are like 25% of your revenue. So if you have a 90, 80% and your running costs are maybe 20-30% as well, right? So if you start up the business when you've got an 80% decline in revenue over 6 months, and you start up the business, and all of a sudden you know your fixed costs are still 25% of your business, your running costs are another 30%. All of a sudden you've got, you know, 50% of what was your previous revenue, but your revenue is still down 50% of where, you know, you are still losing money hand over.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to let Terry jump in here. And the one thing I will say is, as harsh as they sound, tough luck. I mean, I'm sorry. And it is, but that's the reality. That's, you know, in economic terms, it's called creative destruction, economic rationalization. Shit happens. Pardon my French. So, but Terry, please, I'd like for you to weigh in.
I think, like, once again, we're in a very harsh territory with these comments about to make. We're kind of lucky to a degree that, you know, cafes, bars and restaurants and some retail are the ones which have been decimated so much, because in normal time, though, that's a sector which has a huge churn in businesses going out of business every year. So, you know, you think about CBDs, you know, cafes and restaurants turn over so much because they can't pay the bills. And that's where landlords, you know that, you know, I've got a cafe for this year. It might not be there next year, but I'll find another cafe. So there's always this creative destruction in that sector. So the fit-out costs, you know, are enormous for a cafe. So you're not like in a huge amount of debt. You just sort of walk away and start another cafe. And I think the other thing is like the property sector is so diverse in CBDs. You've obviously got your big players who have, you know, spent a lot of money building shiny shopping malls and shiny office towers. And you know, from my observations, those parts of the CBD are the ones with relatively low vacancy rates. You know, the businesses in there are the chains with deeper pockets who have got through this. The places we're seeing lots of for leases and boarded up ones are your older stock, you know, buildings from the 20s, the 30s, the 50s, the 70s, which are probably, you know, even maybe a legacy asset for families, you know, smaller property players who don't have a lot of money invested in that because grandpa bought it in the 20s and it got paid off its mortgage in the 50s, and it's been just a steady stream of sort of free money for a long time. So that's another sort of heartening thing, that there's not a lot of debt associated with those types of properties who have been hard hit by the closures.
That is a fascinating way to look at it. It's amazing. So one of the things that I didn't flag earlier, but it has been started to become a weekly thing for us, is to take a few listener questions. Hello, listeners. So let's start off with Irascible Me, who genuinely has a really good question, which is that will our CBDs survive as they are? And will we need to rethink the mix of commercial, retail, residential? And is it an opportunity for us to improve the quality of some of our CBDs?
You know, people talk about, you know, quality of space when it comes to CBDs to me a lot. Like, and, you know, quality of place means so much, such different things to so many different people. And people are always like, oh, well, like, you know, Melbourne almost made its reputation on, you know, dirty, grungy laneway bars, which, you know, 30 years ago, people might have actually seen as a bad thing, but they actually turned the laneways into a positive.
No, we're not going to do it in Sydney.
Yeah.
I can tell you that now. Like, can you do, metropolitan differentiation?
In my mind, it's basically just, like, don't try and, you know, reinvent your CBD, which in Australia's cases have been built up over 150, 200 years. You know, don't try and reinvent them in the next 6 months. Just see where the world lands. Like, you know, the city of Melbourne, you know, pre-COVID, it had about a million people coming in on any given day on average. You know, I did some back-of-the-envelope estimates, and I reckon, you know, in 2021, there's probably 600,000 people coming in, which just puts it back to where it was sort of 15 years ago in terms of pedestrian counts. So if my back-of-the-envelope numbers are correct, let's just see how the city functions with 600,000 people coming in on a day. Let's see what that means for how many cafes we need, you know, what's the tram and train capacity required under this. Let's just see how that goes, and then try and work out what the world looks like, rather than trying to reinvent them here right now for some future we don't really understand yet.
Just made me realize that if you one of the other thing of like cost transfer is that if the transport network doesn't cost so much to run, or if it isn't as intensive, you can move some of those dollars somewhere else, right? So you can either improve your current service, or you can keep the current service as it is and shift some of those operational costs to other places. Really interesting, you know, where if the city of Sydney or the state government suddenly found, you know, a few million dollars a day in a drawer, what would they do with it? Use it to pay pay down debt, which is a lot, which is very high, or they could do some other things. Anyway, let's move on to another question. Tim Harcourt, who's the airport economist, a great guy. He asks, will working from home lead to more offshoring by Australian companies to qualified workers who are working from home in other countries? And I really love this question. So previously in an office, you needed a graphic designer. Now graphic designer is working from home. Why not get graphic designer in, like I said, Bangalore or wherever at 30% of the cost, and it turns out that giving, you know, paying the person that wage at 30% actually makes their life a whole lot better. What do you think?
Well, it's funny. I saw a couple of big corporates this year, and they were saying that actually they brought call center jobs home from India. And part of the problem was that, you know, I think Bangalore was in lockdown for a period of time, which meant that I was calling up to have my home loan rate adjusted and the phone wasn't being answered in India. So, and I think it's also people, you know, in times of stress, you know, needing more, they can't go into a branch and talk to people face to face, have led to some companies bringing some investments home. And I sort of remember this funny story when it comes to your example about, you know, the graphic designer. It's so often that local knowledge in that context, because I think for a brief period, the Finn Review outsourced some of their sub-editing work to New Zealand.
That's right, yep.
Yeah, and there was this classic day when I opened up the Finn Review, and there's a picture of Barnaby Joyce, I'm sure everyone knows, out the front of Parliament House, and the tagline, which the New Zealand sub-editor had put on, was like, angry protester at Parliament House. He had not recognised Barnaby Joyce for who he was. So that's the kind of thing that, without that local knowledge, you know, things like that can happen.
As somebody who's been in journalism for 20 years, and was an editor, Okay, another question from Jordan Alessio, one of our early guests on the BIP show, guy who's incredibly well read on Bitcoin and gold in particular, but he's a very good macroeconomist. And his question is from this is from Jordan: does this give us an opportunity to reassess GDP growth as a primary measure of progress?
Back when I was a younger man, I did some national accounting at the old ABS in Canberra, and GDP, as much as publicity gets, it's not a measure of progress. You know, it's often confused for being a measure of progress. All it is national income in a given year or given period, and I think, you know, it should always be viewed in the context of all those other indicators. So GDP is one thing, it tells you something, but it's not everything. And that's where, if you really want to understand how society is progressing, you want to look at GDP, that's nice, but then you look at, well, is everyone stuck in horrifically long commutes? You know, is there social exclusion because people live in parts of the city they can't access jobs? I think that question really is, you know, the answer is we shouldn't be thinking about GDP as a measure of progress. We need to be thinking it more about as one measure, and then we've got thinking about, well, what's quality of life and how do you measure that coming through there? Because this has revealed a few, you know, quirks in the system of national accounts about how you measure things, that, you know, I'm not travelling to work, therefore I'm not paying the fare, but I'm getting more leisure time, which isn't picked up in the accounts. So, okay, anyway, this is something I could ramble on about for hours and hours, so you better stop me now.
Yeah, but the fact that you're not paying the fare doesn't, you know, so if you pay the fare, it gets picked up in the national accounts, but you're sitting at home and you might smash out the best proposal of your career because you've had a bit more time to think about it or whatever it is. Yeah, it's an incredibly vexed question, I think, is the really interesting thing. Just like you, Terry, I could talk about this for hours and hours. One other really important question is house prices. All the way over here in Sydney, I can hear Ken Vexler's eyes doing what they're doing.
Nah, don't be like that, Colgo. I mean, you know my view on this, and it doesn't change. My view has not changed. But carry on.
Your view is that the house prices are going up.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, I'm not a property market bull nor bear, but I'm a realist, right? Like, the factors for why they are going up have not changed in 20 years. If anything, there have been factors that have added to why they're going up. The only thing that's deviated in 20, 30 years is the pace of that growth. That's it. So I don't know. I don't get these people that are calling property bubbles and detractors. Like, it's just a reality. That's it.
Well, that's definitely at the macro level. But Terry, maybe you can talk about the geographic split, right? So there's this big question about, you know, does this increase house prices in the outer suburbs?
Well, I think so. If you think about, you know, inner city apartments, that they have taken a value hit because, you know, the foreign workers, the foreign students, the HOSPO workers who were paying the rents in there have all disappeared. And also the vibrancy that the CBD provided there has sort of disappeared as well. So I think apartment prices in that real central core of Sydney and Melbourne, Brisbane, you know, will take a hit. Then you move into the middle ring suburbs where I think, you know, prices have been supported by lower interest rates, you know, and also the message that interest rates will be low for longer. You've also, in that middle ring suburbs with people working from home, they've actually probably got more money in their pockets because they haven't done the, you know, the overseas holiday or holiday Queensland. They haven't been paying.
The household savings rate is like 25%, whereas a normal savings rate would be something like 4%.
Yeah, so I think the most recent accounts had it at a level not seen since the 70s. So there's money in those pockets and people, as discussed, have been spending more time at home and they're craving that bit of, you know, extra space. So they're going to be paying a premium for those suburbs. And also they found out that, you know, that local cafes or local restaurants have become so more valuable to them. And also in those middle ring suburbs, I think the value people have put on open space. So your parklands, your bike paths, which are probably the best in those middle ring suburbs, help support those middle ring suburbs. When you get to the outer suburbs, it's probably a little bit more patchy depending on where you are, because some places were really built up on, you know, that international migration coming through, which has been paused. So there's probably developers will not flood the market, but they'll just keep it ticking along, which probably means if you thought, you know, I bought my house for $500,000 in Western Melbourne, it'll just keep growing in value. But I think now just with this pause in international migration, you know, there'll probably be a little bit more supply of greenfield houses in that area. So you probably won't be seeing growth, but you probably won't see declines either. And then you go into the regions. And I think, you know, in some places, you know, house prices are going to explode just as it doesn't take a lot of people to move to a regional area, you know, whether it's Bendigo, Ballarat, because we've had this really nice case study in Hobart over the last 5 years, where traditionally Hobart's population growth was between 500 people a year and 1,000 people. Then over the last sort of 4 years pre-COVID, it went up to between 1,000 and 1,500 a year. So we're talking about 500 more people moving to Hobart. But yeah, house prices just exploded.
Yeah, and for any of the equity traders out there, they would know what we're talking about here, right? Yes. It's a liquidity problem, right? So,
and these smaller towns, people want to go there from the big cities, but they want to, I think, have a period home, you know, close to the city, cafes, restaurants. They don't want to go there and pay good money for a McMansion on the fringe. And all these smaller towns, you know, they're just not geared up to build more houses because they haven't had to do it, you know, for so long. So it'll just take a few hundred people coming into a regional market, which will just send off property prices like a rocket.
And so when you say a few hundred people, it might be as little as a few dozen people in some places.
Right? Yeah, it's so. Like if you know those smaller sort of hamlets outside of the regional centres, yeah, because there's just not enough housing to go around and you just can't build it that fast. nor with the period charm that people are looking for.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So, by the way, that was in response to a question from, let me call him out because he's a good guy, Luke Winchester. Thanks, Luke. Okay. So, this has been a fascinating conversation. Thank you very much, Terry. I think one thing that's important, Ken, given what we normally talk about, I know since we've known each other, probably the biggest theme of our lives has been that stocks are at all-time highs and the Australian dollar is a little bit higher than the RBA would like it. But yeah. Let's just quickly talk about markets. Isn't it wild?
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, the Seppos are off eating turkey and watching football, and they're going to take another couple of days off after the fact. The dynamic of why stocks are here, the underlying dynamic, in my opinion, hasn't changed in recent months, isn't going to change in the ensuing months. There is no finer mattress under which to put your cash. So stocks, not unlike Australian property, will continue to go up. It's just the pace that may deviate. And the Australian dollar is, you know, again, as we've covered several times, it's a high beta to the overall risk appetite, of which stocks are, you know, the perfect gauge. So equity's higher, risk appetite seemingly higher, Aussie higher. But one thing that is interesting, there's been a lot of talk in the last probably week, 10 days, all the sell side notes, all the talking heads on TV, et cetera, all the strategists are talking about a weaker US dollar. Not that we've just seen it, but like a sustainably weaker US dollar in the coming months. I'm not arguing the case. I'm not anti the case. But one thing I think people fail to realize, and this has been a very much a story of this year, is that ultimately markets discount stuff. Like they are a discounting mechanism, and people have a difficulty coming to terms with the fact that the market is actually actively discounting it. So I would argue that this weakness in the US dollar that everyone's anticipating to go on for months and months, I think a lot of it's already there. And I just struggle to see where that next push comes from. And when it does finally come, well, when is it? I mean, we're talking, yeah, probably a good couple of months, so early next year, if and when. But so that's something that's been sort of troubling me. As in, you know, everyone wants a weaker dollar, says it's going to happen. Can't really explain why.
Well, particularly when Janet Yellen is shaping up to be Treasury Secretary in the US. And mm-hmm. actually, James, who's out on a boat, or he might be off the boat here, it's getting to sunset. I don't know what time they bring those boats in, but James is always talking about that grey line between central banking and the executive branch of government. And and I think it's a really interesting question now with a former head of the Fed heading into Treasury. It certainly confirms that trend, but it also makes you wonder what's going to happen to the US dollar, because Yellen will be supremely conscious of the effect that fiscal policy will have on the Fed.
But that's the thing. Like, I mean, you know, everyone was like, oh, my God, the FOMC minutes out last night. It'll give a cue as to what they're going to do in December. Bollocks. Like, market didn't move. Janet Yellen announced as the nominee for Treasury Secretary. Market discounted it within about 3 seconds. Nothing happened. Headlines, big deal. You know, let's, as I said, the misconception this year for me has been that, you know, markets are slow to discount or to price and whatever else. Well, I think the real conversation is that, you know, no one's been able, you know, no one can conceive that the tail has already been priced, right? So bottom line is, I think everything we know right now is already in the price. So short of aliens landing or, I don't know, let's see what happens.
Yeah. There's a great piece by Stephen Kirchner, who is was a guest of ours early in the series. We are now up to 26 episodes, by the way, which is amazing.
Wow.
I'm totally exhausted even just saying it out loud. But Stephen was pointing out that, like, over time, markets are becoming more and more efficient. So they're better and better at pricing in every possible scenario. From my observations over time, anybody who thinks that the market is missing a trick is a mug. So there is one other thing, though, I think that's important. And Terry, it's a question for you, because you look at the domestic Australian economy so closely. The Australian dollar is at almost 74 cents, right? So 73.5 as we're talking. The RBA has in the past used language like uncomfortably high, etc., you know, to describe the level of the currency. What do you think about in the current context, with all the things that we need to do to drive economic growth, Aussie dollar at 73.5 cents, what does that mean?
Yeah, look, it's something that I get more and more nervous about, it, especially with our central bankers trying to talk the dollar down and nudge it down. It's just sort of had plenty of strength. And the challenge is, over the last, you know, few years, it's sort of bounced in this range of, you know, 69, 74-ish, probably that high. And, you know, for exporters, you know, a couple of cents either way, you can sort of, if it's down a bit when you make your sale, if it's up a little bit, you can sort of either a bit more profit or a bit less profit for exporters. But my concern, if it starts to sort of break above that 75 and heads towards 80, it just makes things so much more uncomfortable for Australian exporters, and also brings in more and more cheaper imports. So I think it really is at an awkward or uncomfortable point where we do want to see that dollar come down, you know, a couple of cents, just so it sort of stays in that historical range and there's more certainty for everyone.
Yeah, and Ken, to your point, you know, if US dollar weakness was to be the thing, the Aussie dollar would do the opposite, right?
Well, obviously, I mean, you know, and it's the major currency that it trades against. So, yeah, if the dollar really fell out of bed, the US dollar, then Aussie has plenty of room to rally. But, you know, that's a big if in my book.
And that's a scenario where we've got plenty of headwinds on the Australian economy, the real economy. You know, having that dollar creep upwards and just sort of crimp that export sector and the competing imports, we don't need that at this point in time.
No. And quickly on equity prices, Terry, Dow 30,000, all that kind of stuff. So fine, and there's a lot of reasons behind that. But equity prices are high. Chris Weston, who is a good friend of the show, I'll always remember him saying a few years ago, saying to me that the smartest thing you can do as an investor is to do what the Fed wants you to do, which is, you know, at the time was, you know, sell the dollar and buy equities. And it wouldn't have been you would have lost on selling the dollar, but you would have been okay on buying equities. You were like 3 years ago. You know, how do you think the equity prices look in terms of, like, overall macro risk?
Well, I think, you know, Ken summed it up pretty well earlier. The markets have priced in what they perceive to be the risks. But, you know, we are in a unprecedented time, you know, huge amounts of liquidity, interest rates at 3,000-year lows. There's money looking for homes, and it's going into stocks and housing. And I suppose the good thing about, you know, house prices being, you know, pretty robust in the big cities in Australia, the share market rallying, it's helping people who have had a, you know, tough year. You know, that wealth effect will hopefully kick in as well. So, you know, people seeing the property prices not falling, you know, the share portfolio heading in the right direction will once again give them confidence, plus the 25% savings ratio in the last quarter, to get out there and spend money. Consumers, if you're listening, get out there and spend money.
Agreed. And get back into your offices, because thriving cities are very important for us. Look, don't forget to subscribe to the show, rate us and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. We're on iTunes and Spotify, and just search The BIP Show. We're also on Twitter. It's at the underscore BIP underscore show. And we're on Facebook too. Just search The BIP Show. We're there individually at Colgo, at James Whelan 42, who's on a boat, at Ken Vexler, and Terry's handle is at T-Raw Oz. You can find Terry, and he's genuinely one of the smartest people in terms of thinking about how local economies work in Australia today. So, Terry, thanks so much for coming on the show. It's been great to have you on.
Oh, look, no, it's been a pleasure, Paul and Ken, being here. I could talk about this stuff all night, but we all have our lives to return to.
Well, that's right. It's literally the sun is going down here in Sydney. Ken, have a fantastic day in Amsterdam. I hope it's a great weekend for you.
Thank you, Colgo, and thank you, Terry, for coming on. Very, very eye-opening and enlightening. Really appreciated the chat. Thanks, man.
Great.
I've got one very exciting bit of news to share with those of you who have managed to stay until the end of the show. We are going to be reprising the Christmas special between me, James Whelan, David Scott, Joanne Masters, and Laura Fitzsimmons from JP Morgan. We're going to be reprising that towards the end of the year. So the best thing you can do to make sure you don't miss it is hit subscribe, rate the show, and just make sure that you don't miss that episode. It'll be the week before Christmas. And this was something that we did, I think, 3 years in a row, and it became a bit of a tradition, and it was really fun. Frankly, if you had listened to the investment insights on all of those podcasts, you would have done pretty well the year following. So they were pretty fun. Okay, so the show is produced by Eamon Connolly and Rick Salter. We will catch you next time. Terry Ronsley, thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure.
And thanks again for listening.